I wanted to welcome all of you here tonight to our forum that we've entitled New York Prisons Inside and Out, an invitation to consider needed reform. My name is Edie Regan, and I serve as Coordinator of Justice and Peace Ministry for Catholic Charities of Tompkins County. I wanted to thank the many local groups who have been a part of organizing tonight's program, as well as a number of witness activities that took place earlier today at Southport, Elmira, and Cayuga Correctional Facilities. So thanks to the Tompkins County Interfaith Campaign to Reform the Rockefeller Drug Laws, the Tompkins County Coalition Against the Death Penalty, the Ithaca Friends Meeting, the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, Offender Aid and Restoration, and the Ithaca Catholic Worker. I also wanted to extend a special thanks to the Judicial Process Commission in Rochester in the Western New York Peace Center based in Buffalo for envisioning the New York Interfaith Prison Pilgrimage and for bringing it here to Ithaca today. It's good that we're gathered here tonight. Last evening, I spoke with someone on the telephone who works within one of our local prison systems. He told me how much it has meant to the prisoners he works with just to know that some people are thinking of them and are trying to make things better. Our presence here tonight testifies that we haven't forgotten those who live behind bars day in and day out, that we care about them as our brothers and sisters in the human family, and that we want to create positive change within the prison system and the whole criminal justice system. At our community forum here this evening, as with all the local programs that are connected with the prison pilgrimage, we intend this to be a safe place where all views may be expressed and heard. Tonight, we're very fortunate to be joined by several people who have a great deal of knowledge and experience with a variety of criminal justice issues. They are Tom Terese, Leslie Jones, Bill Russin, Kim LaSalva, and Chuck Culhane. I first wanted to introduce to you Tom Terese. Tom is the Executive Director of Prisoners Legal Services of New York. Prisoners Legal Services is a not-for-profit legal services program which provides civil legal services to indigent prisoners in New York's 70 prisons. He'll be speaking to us this evening about prison conditions. So welcome, Tom.
Thank you. I wanted to focus on, in speaking about general prison conditions, I know there are going to be people talking about the drug laws and drug treatment programs and so on, but I want to talk about a particular couple of areas that my program, Prisoners Legal Services, deals with extensively, and which I also think are some of the most serious problems in the New York State prison system today. In particular, New York has the unfortunate distinction of having more solitary confinement cells or more isolation cells than any prison system in the country and probably the world. Over the last 5 years, there was a building boom in New York, pushed by the governor and unfortunately agreed to by members of the legislature, where they expanded the number of isolation cells by doubling them up to about 5,500. So today there are about 5,500, maybe even a little bit more than that, people in isolation. And what isolation means in New York, it depends on what prison you're at. Some of the older prisons, you're in a single cell by yourself 23 hours a day. When you come out for the hour of exercise, you're usually shackled and taken into another room or a cage or some sort of enclosure where you're sometimes left shackled for the hour. Sometimes the shackles come off. But while you're sitting in your cell, you have very limited access to any kind of reading material. You have little access to anyone. You can talk to the people on either side of you, although you can't see them because you're in a single cell. And you're pretty much relying upon an occasional porter to come by or a guard during the day. The other distinction that New York has about their isolation system is that they put people in isolation for longer than any place else in the country. Most states have disciplinary systems set up in their prison system whereby if an inmate violates an institutional rule, they can have a hearing. And after that hearing, if they're found guilty, they can be placed in isolation for a period of time. A typical hearing in New York takes, it varies on the type of charge, but the most important thing is that inmates do not have a right to be represented at those hearings, regardless of their condition, regardless of whether or not they're mentally ill or can't speak English or have some other disability. They do not have a right to be represented. But the consequences of those hearings are drastic. As I said before, there's really no limit in New York the amount of time somebody can be placed in isolation. Or at the same, during the same hearings, there's no limit to the amount of good time credits that they have already earned that can be taken away at those hearings. Over the years, just as the punishment for criminal offenses has gone up with the tough on crime attitudes of legislators, so have the disciplinary punishments gone up in New York State. It used to be fairly unusual that you'd hear somebody getting a sentence of 6 months in solitary confinement. But today, it's not unusual, and I think anybody who works in our practice would not be shocked to hear somebody who got 7 years in solitary confinement. There's a certain shift that's taken place, and in part because they have the cells now for isolation purposes, they'll fill them up. It's not the average sentence that somebody gets 7 years, but it's also not the longest that we've had to deal with in New York. Just as an example, my program, which has sort of been larger at times and smaller at other times, but our typical practice was that we would not even look at a case for review just simply because we didn't have the staff and the volume involved. We wouldn't look at a case unless somebody had at least a year in solitary confinement. Over this past year, when we were having some funding difficulties, that rose to 2 years. So we wouldn't even be able to look at a case to review it to see if there's any legal action possible unless somebody was confined for 2 years. I think the longest term I've ever heard of anybody in New York is 18 years for a particular offense. And even after that person served those 18 years, they moved him into a different category and still kept him in isolation. That would be bad enough, except that what's happened in New York is that the special housing units, the isolation units, have become essentially dumping grounds for the mentally ill in the state prison system. In some cases, up to 50% of the people who are sitting in the special housing units have some sort of a serious mental illness. And this has come about for a variety of reasons. The Department of Justice has estimated in a study they did recently that about 17% of prison inmates around the country, state prison inmates, have some sort of a serious mental illness. And that means by the time they got to prison, they had actually spent some time in a mental institution or had received mental health treatment for a serious mental illness. So in New York, 17% of its currently 67,000 inmates is somewhere in the range of 12 to 13,000 inmates. These are people who have already been diagnosed as having some sort of a serious mental illness. And just as those folks are having difficulty making it on the street, they have equal difficulty making it, as you can understand, in the general population of the facilities. And so oftentimes they end up in the special housing units. As a result, sometimes of violating an institutional rule that's relatively minor, they get a sentence of maybe 30 to 60 days or sometimes three months in the special housing units. But once in there, because of the isolation, their conditions deteriorate and they continue to get additional tickets for violations of institutional rules, either throwing something at a guard or self-mutilation or some other thing that violates an institutional rule. And yes, you can actually go to isolation. You can go to the box for trying to commit suicide in the state. Actually, a client that I'm working on his case right now, who went in initially on a three-month disciplinary punishment, and he's been in there continuously for 7 years now because of additional tickets he's received. As a matter of fact, he's due to get out in about 3 months and has not been out of isolation for 7 years. And what's happened with him, which is somewhat typical in these cases, is that he's also lost all of his good time as well as getting these disciplinary punishments, so that he will be released in July with $40 in his pocket and a bus ticket and sent out into the world. He won't even be on parole because he's maxing out, so he's not going to have any of the supportive services that parole could even provide. In some cases, that's not much. but he's just going to be dumped on the street without any kind of pre-release programming, without anybody working with him. He's going to come out of solitary confinement after 7 years. We, in particular, have been trying to deal with some of these issues through a series of cases that have been in the courts for about 12 years. We first tried to tackle this problem at Attica, where we saw some of the most seriously mentally ill. And one of the claims in that case was that they just simply were not providing any kind of a treatment for people who were in the special housing units. For example, there is a psychiatrist who's assigned to the unit, but when we studied her records and looked at the logbooks, we found that she spent on an average about 10 minutes per month with each of the people on her caseload. That was the level of therapy that was being provided. The typical therapy, of course, is to medicate people and forcibly medicate them when necessary. But oftentimes, people who are in there with serious mental illness to compensate to a point where they have to be taken out and taken to the Central New York Psychiatric Center, where, oddly enough, they seem to recover. In a therapeutic community, they can actually recover. They are medicated, but they actually treated in a different way, not isolated. They actually recover. But what happens then is they get patched up and sent back into solitary to serve the remainder of their time. So we've been trying to break that cycle, especially where people have been identified as having serious mental problems and cannot tolerate the prolonged isolation of the special housing units. We've tried to, through these a series of lawsuits, stop that process and get the Department of Corrections and the Office of Mental Health to develop other programs, a range of programs for people in non-isolation settings to treat their mental illness. One thing that's important to keep in mind is that approximately 90-95% of people come out of prison and come back into the communities. And unless problems that they have when they take in are dealt with, they're going to come out in worse shape than when they went in. And this is, I think, a real public safety issue. This case I mentioned before of this individual who is going to come out after 7 years in solitary and be dumped on the streets is a real one. There's no transition services usually. We repeatedly see situations where people are on medications when they get released, but get to the community and can't get on Medicaid right away. They can't access medical care right away. And they're left for sometimes 30, 60 days without any kind of treatment. I think the system itself has broken down at a lot of different levels. And in part, it's not entirely the fault of the correction system because they're not really designed to be a mental health facility. The real problem lies with the Office of Mental Health and their inability to deal with this population, and I think their desire not to deal with it. But in any event, there is litigation going on now that's trying to deal with that. But more importantly, I think there's a new initiative that just happened this year that's been started by the Chief Judge of the New York Court of Appeals, Judith Kaye, where she's setting up a mental health court in Brooklyn. The model is sort of based on the drug court model, where people who are identified at their first encounter with the criminal justice system and they're identified as having a serious mental issue and they're sort of screened out, they're diverted into treatment programs and there's a stay on the criminal case while that more serious mental health problem is taken care of. I think that's the correct model to look at, that once people get caught up in this web, it's very difficult for them to get out of it because at many places they're not represented and there's nobody there to assert their claims. But some sort of a structure like the mental health courts might be a way to keep those people out of the correctional facilities, divert them out at the first opportunity, and not expect the correction system to deal with it.
Thanks, Tom. I now want to invite to the podium Leslie Jones. Leslie is an attorney. As a matter of fact, she formerly worked for Prisoners Legal Services. She is a death penalty activist and is currently director of Southside Community Center.
Good evening. It's really good to see all of you here, and it's good to be a part of the pilgrimage that is taking on such a very important issue, an issue in our community, whether or not we've ever been incarcerated, an issue primarily for this place because we're surrounded by prisons. I had some statistics that I was going to share with you on the death penalty, but I'm actually going to change my angle on that because I think Part of the process of doing what we're here to talk about today, which is activism, comes from recognizing that this is a personal issue, which is why as people who live in this area and we're we're looking at prison issues, why we need to take this very seriously and not just consider it as an academic exercise, but to also consider it as part of what it is that we do on a daily basis to create change in our community. I had always been against the death penalty. I remember writing papers when I was in high school. I remember, you know, not thinking it was a good thing that the state legally killed people. I remember, you know, thinking about things when I was in church with Jesus Christ being executed by the state. So I had always had a problem with executions and the death penalty as a whole, but I didn't really feel connected to that position other than to think that it was a bad thing. While I was a college student in Atlanta, Georgia, I was listening to the radio one day. It was a commercial, non-commercial radio station down in Atlanta. And a man's voice came on and he did a commentary. And that man was Mumia Abu-Jamal. And at the end of the commentary, I don't even remember what he was talking about, but he talked about something that was very, very clear. It was very something that was a social issue. And it touched me how he articulated the issue. And then at the end of his commentary, as at the end of all of his commentaries, he says, from death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. And that death row part is what I definitely remember, because it was very strange to me to have heard something so thoughtful and so moving and to hear, you know, that this was a person that was on death row. As a young person, I always just thought that death row, you know, obviously they did something. Why would they be there? I didn't think that they should be killed for whatever it was that they had done. But it was this dark and gloomy place where people just got put, basically. I never considered these to be articulate people. I never considered them to be in any way educated. Any of the things that I guess some middle-class kid probably, you know, thinks about. But I decided at that moment that I needed to do something, because here was a person that was articulating an issue from death row, and I was on the street. I was driving around in a car in Atlanta, you know, going to school. So I felt like there was something that I should do. I decided to go to law school as one of the options that I would take to do something. I won't make a comment about lawyers since I'm in the presence of several of them, but I can't really say that law school was really necessarily where I found that activist spirit. In fact, it was one of the most conservative places I've probably ever been in my life. But from my involvement in Philadelphia, when I went to law school in Philadelphia, which is where I'm from, it became very clear to me that the death penalty was very personal. Because I'm not sure about you, and I'm pretty sure, but I'm not sure about everyone, but most of us drink water from a bottle, do we not? And, you know, a lot of us have asthma, and some of us even have to buy breathing machines to help us to breathe. And if we don't recognize that that is death row, I'm not sure where we can go with some of what we do as activists. When I consider the fact that they serve health food at Green Star and in the marketplace at Wegmans, I have to always think to myself, well, what are they serving on those other aisles in the grocery store if the health food is dedicated to this one particular area? So in my activism in Philadelphia, thinking of all these things, thinking about the environment, thinking about restrictions on people's lives where you have parents who have to work 3 and 4 jobs just to make ends meet, thinking about the state of incarceration, not just in New York, but around the country, where increasingly there are more young Black men in prison than they are in school, thinking about the type of economic circumstances and the public educational system that a lot of these same young people of color feel like the only way that they can get any economic development is by selling drugs on the corner. Noticing all of these things, to me, that's death row. And it's not to mitigate the situation that Mumia and around 3,500 other people find themselves at this point in the United States, because death row is a very serious place. We heard about 23-hour lockdown, and that is their existence. 23 hours in a cell the size of your bathroom. When you do have recreation, you go to a cage. You're in a cage to have your recreation time. A lot of these prisons also being newly built are really expert at sensory deprivation, at making sure that there's no contact, making sure that there is very minimal interaction between a person that's on death row and the outside world, whether it's their family, whether it's activists such as yourselves who are going across the state on this pilgrimage, whether it's other people that are just interested in finding out more about death row. In Pennsylvania in particular, they've taken out the capacity of journalists to come in and do interviews, for people to come in and document what happens. You know, all of these things combined make death row a very restricted, a very limited, and a very slow death process, even before you're executed. But I don't want us as people outside on the street not to realize what position we find ourselves in, and the fact that all of these things are connected. And that's where my activism comes from. And that is where the thrust of my activism lies. Actions such as this, when we go on the pilgrimages, when we go out on the streets and demonstrate, when we go and lobby our legislators, all of these things are very valuable. This is not a one, as a younger person thinking, what can I do? Okay, law school is the way to go. You know, there isn't a one avenue mechanism that works here. This is a combined effort. So whether you're a journalist, as Mumia is, and you write about these issues, whether you are someone that likes to hit the streets and you either go door to door, you fill up, a lane of traffic, or you take your arguments to a state representative or a state senator or some other public or political official. On Monday, the 100th person was released from death row, out of Arizona, I believe. I don't know all of the details, but that's the 100th person that wasn't supposed to be here. The death penalty is not fairly applied. The death penalty, in terms of how it's litigated in the courts, in terms of how the court system is set up to deal with the death penalty, and the fact that most people on death row are indigent, they're poor people who don't or can't afford the types of representation that other people with wealth who have been accused of murder in recent years have been able to afford, and have therefore precluded themselves from being victims of the death penalty or even, you know, a capital sentence. Part of the other issue with people on death row is that there are many people who are mentally retarded. So death rows are filled with people who at times don't even really recognize what's happening to them. There was a man in Mississippi, I remember when I was in law school, I participated in a study, and it was an attorney from Mississippi who had come up and was talking about one of his former clients who had been executed. And he absolutely had no idea what was happening to him. He thought that when they took him to where the execution was going to take place, that he was going to come back. There's so many errors that to allow the state to kill people in light of the fact that there's judicial misconduct, there's prosecutorial misconduct, and police misconduct, the fact that you have a lot of indigent clients represented by attorneys who aren't prepared or don't have the resources to really handle the case, I'm not really sure what kind of system that is, and how we as taxpayers, how we as conscious people, how we, you know, ourselves who could likewise fall under the same types of situation where we define ourselves in those categories could stand for such. And so thank you.
Thanks, Leslie. Now I'd like to introduce to you Bill Russin. Since August of 2002, Bill has served as the executive director of Cornerstone Recovery Services, formerly known as Alpha House.
Tonight, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the Rockefeller drug laws. I know there's been a lot of commentary on that lately, especially in the local hometown press. I'd like to spend a couple minutes just giving you a little background about the drug laws. I'm not a lawyer, as two of my panelists are, and I'm not a social scientist. I'm merely a social worker who, for a couple of years now,
runs a substance abuse treatment facility. So all of that disclaimer in place, I will proceed. The Rockefeller drug laws were obviously named for Nelson Rockefeller. They were enacted in 1973. They required judges to give drug offenders mandatory minimum sentences regardless of their background, character, or role in the offense. Critics charge that these laws put judges in a legal straitjacket and frequently give too much power to prosecutors whose actions are not always or very infrequently reviewed or accountable to anyone in particular. Most prisoners serving sentences for drug crimes are people who possess drugs for their own use, low-level sellers or couriers. Under the drug laws, the possession of 4 ounces or sale of 2 ounces of narcotic substance is a Class A felony and carries a penalty of 15 years to life in prison. Possession of 2 ounces or the sale of 0.5 ounce of narcotic mandates 3 years to life in prison. Persons convicted of a Class A felony, regardless of the nature of their involvement, receive the same maximum sentence as people convicted of murder, arson, and kidnapping. 45% of all Class A drug felons have no prior criminal conviction of any kind. And these sentences are more harsh than the minimum sentences handed out in the federal system, which are mandatory, which require a 5-year sentence for a first offense sale of 500 grams or nearly 18 ounces of cocaine. I think it's important to realize that the increase in those incarcerated for drug offenses in New York State is pretty staggering. In 1980, it was about 9%. Now it's about 34% of the prison population. And I think one thing we don't always think about is, in a sense, how the drug laws feminized the prison population. The increase in that time period is staggering for women, who are 60.4% of the women currently in prison were sentenced for drug crimes. Over 70% of these men and women have never been convicted of a violent felony. And these drug laws appear to have a disproportionate impact on people of color. While African Americans and Latinos comprise about 32% of New York's population, they comprise a staggering 94% of those currently incarcerated for drug felonies, even though drug selling and use appears to be almost proportional between the races. And interesting, again, among women, 82% of Latina women and 71% of African American women sentenced to prison were sentenced for drug offenses, compared with 41% of white women. And, you know, obviously statistics have a sort of a numbing effect, I guess, if you spend a lot of time with them. And I was looking for information about commentary on the drug laws. And I'm sort of a great believer in the old saying, you know, only Nixon could go to China. So I was sort of bouncing around looking for who would comment on the drug laws. And I came up against the 1993 testimony of Thomas A. Coughlin III, who at that time was the New York State Corrections Commissioner. And I'm just going to, until I tell you otherwise, I will be reading quotes from his testimony. "I think we desperately need to modify our approach to the drug epidemic plaguing New York State. My position has long been that prison space is a finite resource. We should be filling them with people we built them for, the violent predators and the repeat offenders, not the guy who gets caught with a few bucks of worth of crack. The time is long overdue for the legislature to recognize this distinction and enact some basic reforms to our sentencing structure. I firmly believe that drug addiction affecting the street-level addict can be far more successfully treated in community settings instead of the prison environment. It would make far more sense, logistically and economically, to provide initial diversion from the prison system to community-based treatment providers in the first instance for the street-level addict. Treatment, not punishment, should be our first line of defense for nonviolent addicts in our so-called war against drugs." It ought to be obvious we are locking up people for their addiction at a higher rate than for those who commit violence against us. For example, if you explain to the public that the law currently has an identical 8 to 25 year maximum sentencing range for a person who commits forcible rape and for a person who sells a dollar's worth of cocaine, I believe it would tell you that our legal sense of priorities is totally out of whack. Yet, that is exactly what the current law provides. The totality of overall drug commitments has increased at an astronomical rate and now significantly surpasses commitments for violent felonies and other coercive crimes. And I think it's interesting when someone who ran the corrections department has such a strong opinion about what is happening, or interestingly enough, what was happening 9 years ago to the prison system. Now, as I mentioned, there has been some local commentary about the drug laws. And for those of you that don't know, there were two editorials in the Ithaca Journal last Thursday. And I wanted to just share some of the things that I thought were important about what I read that day. And I would try to give attribution to those who made the comments. Ms. Barry, who's here, cited some interesting things that I read and made me think about, in social policy, the concept of intended and unintended consequences to social policy. In 1998, New York State spent twice as much on higher education as it did on prisons. In 1997, I believe that's 9 years later, the state spent $100 million more on prisons than on higher education, an amount that pushed the state prison share of the general fund from just under 10% to just under 25%. And when I look at the competition for public dollars in Tompkins County, the competition for public dollars, for instance, for school systems, the public school systems in New York State, it's not hard to imagine that one of the reasons we might be having a problem with those issues now is unintended, I hope, or perhaps intended, I hope not, consequences of the Rockefeller drug laws. If the state pie is only one pie, and instead of taking out a 10% slice, you need a quarter slice, that means there's not as much left for other important things. And the last thing I'll quote from Ms. Barry's editorial is, a recent RAND study found that drug treatment reduces crimes 15 times more than mandatory sentences and 10 times more than conventional sentences. You know, I wrote a letter to the newspaper a few weeks ago, and they were nice enough to publish it. And, you know, it's a question, you know, I'm a convergent thinker. I'm one of those people who has to take a lot of complex things and try to boil them down to one or two ideas in my head. And what it comes down to is, I think you either have to believe that people can transform themselves, or you don't believe it. I hate to be simplistic about it, but I think a lot of times, sort of like Curly said in City Slickers, it really does come down to one thing. And I think you have to think about the fact that if you believe substance abuse and addiction is a disease, and the American Medical Association said it was in 1958, not a new concept, then you have to look at locking people up for the disease is really akin to if you have insulin-sensitive diabetes, for locking you up for a while because you just can't resist that Oreo cookie. It sounds a little crazy, because I think it is a little crazy. And I talked to a reporter the other day about this, and she was asking me about the drug laws. And I said, you know, I can understand all the reasons the drug laws might have come into effect. Because in 1972, you know, I was of age, and I understood, Well, I understood things as I understood them being 18 years old, which wasn't nearly as clear then as it is now. But I understood that there were a lot of difficult things happening in the United States. And I can understand people's fear and anxiety and their sense of dislocation and disorientation because of the deaths of Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and all the upheaval that started. I can understand all those things. But I also understand what Mr. Lincoln said at the end of the Civil War. And he said, we really have to follow the angels of our better nature. So, you know, when I look at the Rockefeller drug laws, what I'm left with is the realization that a lot of addicted people go untreated. And in our work, we're lucky enough sometimes to see people who don't go to prison and go to perhaps long-term drug treatment or outpatient treatment or intensive outpatient treatment care, and they get well. They transform their lives. And I'll just sort of end it by saying, from my perspective, what I asked people to do in the letter I wrote. And on a very personal level, I ask people to dare to believe in the ability of people to transform themselves, to dare to be an example of that sort of tolerance and belief in people, and dare to do the difficult thing, which would be to treat people humanely and humanly and as if we followed the angels of our better nature. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Bill. I wanted to introduce to you now Kim LaSelva. Kim is someone who has some personal experience with the Rockefeller drug laws and who made the very courageous choice about a month ago to go public with her story. And it's been in the journal, and she's taken quite a bit of heat from making that decision. Kim is also a coworker of mine at Catholic Charities and someone for whom I and the rest of the Catholic Charity staff have the utmost respect as a coworker, as a mother, and as a wonderful human being. I want to welcome Kim LaSelva.
Thank you. I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight and this wonderful, wonderful weather that we have tonight. And on my way down, driving down the hill, down 13, with my window down and my music turned up and the wind coming and brushing against my face, I thought back to 2 years ago when I desired that feeling. But the only contact I had with the lovely weather was sitting in a fenced-in, maybe as big as a small basketball court. And that was how far my enjoyment for the weather could go. I, about 2 years ago, did not ever really think about the drug laws, the Rockefeller drug laws. Didn't really know much about them. Only thought, well, yeah, I guess, you know, people who do bad things need to be punished, and selling drugs is not good. So, yeah, that sounds about right. Until about March of 2000, when my house was raided. And in my house, they found about 7 ounces of cocaine. The time preceding that, about a month before that, I was in a relationship with my children's father. We were living together. I was raising my son with him and his son from a previous relationship. Our relationship really was not good at that point. He was doing some things that I knew was wrong, and at that time, my tolerance level was getting very, very low. I didn't want him around anymore just for the sake of having a father for my children. Our relationship became physically abusive, and at that time, I was about 7 months pregnant when he basically beat me up like I was a man. At that point, we had a discussion with each other and knew that at that time our relationship needed to end. At the time that my house was raided, my boyfriend's belongings were all in plastic bags, garbage bags, near my door. And after days of trying to get a hold of him, I couldn't reach him, and my phone in my house was disconnected. So around 8:30 that night, I had, you know, my younger one, who was about 16 months old at the time, was asleep. And my other child, who was 8, his child with in a previous relationship who was 8, was up watching TV, and I told him I needed to use the phone. I'm going across the street to use the phone. Now, my mother, who lived right next door to me in the next apartment, would be coming home within about 10 minutes. So he knew where she lived. She would normally come over when she would come home. And so I felt that it was okay so that I could step out and use the phone to try and call my ex-boyfriend to come and get his things. Well, unknown to me, while I was exiting my house, there was investigators watching me and documenting my every step and move. And during the time that I had left my house and was using the phone, that's when they went in my house and raided my house. And they had to come across the street from which happened to be a bar that I was using the payphone at and bring me back into my house, where as I entered, I saw about 20 police officers in my house, some in uniforms, some not, some Ithaca City policemen, some state troopers. And I had no idea, you know, why all of these people were in my house, what is going on. My little one was up crying and screaming. The 8-year-old was saying, "Mommy, Mommy, they had guns when they came in the door." I'm thinking, oh my God. When the officers who were in my house handed me the search warrant, I'm looking through these papers and I'm saying, well, okay, so what does this have to do with me? Because my name's not even on any of these papers. You know, this is my apartment. You know, and this is not me. Why are you here if it's not for me? Well, you know who we're here for. Where is he? I said, I have no idea. Those are his things right there. We're no longer together. Anyway, I had to end up going to the police department, sitting there for hours. My family had to be called. I had my pastor come down, my mother, my grandmother, my aunt, my uncle. Everybody came to the police station wanting to know what was going on, demanding answers. And all they told my family was that, well, she's about to go to prison for 15 years. While they're sitting there talking to me and telling me I have all these rights at 9 o'clock in the evening, that I could certainly pick up the phone and call a lawyer at that time if I wanted representation, which was very funny to me. They kept telling me the whole time that basically, you know, it's not you, Kim, that we want. You know you know where your boyfriend is. Why don't you just let us know so you can go home? And I refused to say anything because I didn't know. I was trying to contact him. Obviously, I didn't know. What is going on here? You know, why are you having me here if you're telling me that you don't want me here? Well, I ended up going to the county jail. At this time, I was 8 months pregnant. You know, looking at what I was up against, I had no idea what was going to happen. I just thought, okay, they'll find him, they'll let me go, and I'll be able to go back to my normal life. Well, that didn't happen. I needed a lawyer, and I needed one fast. Did not have the money to get adequate representation at that time. I was appointed an attorney who at the time, when I told him about the events that happened beforehand, he basically sat there and told me, well, Kim, it's a no-brainer. Okay, it doesn't matter what your story is. Doesn't matter how much you cry, you know, how much you plead. The point is that there was drugs found in your house, and that is your apartment, and you are guilty. And if you go to trial and cry and plead, the bottom line is there was drugs in your house, whether you bought them and put them there or not, and that was your apartment. You will be found guilty, and you will be imposed with this 15 years to life sentence. And I just couldn't live with that. I could not live knowing that the child that I was about to have in a month, that I would be watching him grow up behind bars. That did not sit right with me. I could go on and on and on, and I'll probably end up crying hysterically. Basically, what happened was I ended up having my child in the jail. That in itself was a whole nother issue. But I was able to have him with me till he was 4 months old in the jail, and was offered a plea bargain of 3 years to life. And since, you know, I finished high school, I knew that, well, 3 years to life was a hell of a lot better than 15 years to life. And so I took the plea and basically had to let go of what happened before, you know, knowing that I wasn't going to be able to speak to the judge in front of the judge and let him know what was going on and what I had to do in it, what was my part in this, which was nothing, and say that I was guilty. And that was the hardest thing for me to do, but I knew that I had to do that in order to come home quickly to my children. And thank God that I had such a supportive family through this whole thing. Otherwise, I don't know what would have happened. You know, for somebody never being convicted of anything before, this was hard for me. And, you know, I just thank God every day for them. I ended up going to shock incarceration for 6 months, which was basically like a military boot camp. Had to shave my head, had to get up 5:30 in the morning, exercise for an hour and a half, and run 4 miles every single day. I think the only day that we didn't was Christmas. I think because this area that I was at was up in Buffalo, and I was there during the winter time, having to do this outside, they were gracious enough to let us do it inside that day. So, you know, the Rockefeller drug laws really impacted me, and I really feel strongly about them now, especially have going through it. If not anything at all, just what's unfair about it is that people, regardless of what was going on before their time of their arrest, have no opportunity to speak for themselves, have no opportunity under this innocent until proven guilty thing that the law says. It's unfair. It's unfair that I did not have a voice. It's unfair that I had to say I was guilty when I know that I wasn't. It was unfair that I had to leave my children, even though it was only for a total of a year. It was unfair. And I'm still working on my relationship with my children. And it's been a hard thing for me. But I am blessed that I'm able to be home and surrounded by people who are supportive and care about me and love me. I'm glad that during that time I was able to think positively about it, as like many other people who don't. You know, they see that as this is what's going on. It'll be like this forever. You know, they're just gonna lock me up again. And I have a different attitude about that. But some people don't, and they need help. I'm just glad that I know who I am today. You know, I'm no longer inmate LaSelva, 00G1031. I'm a mother, I'm a daughter, I'm a sister, and I'm Kimberly Lynn LaSelva. Thank you.
The last panelist we'll hear from this evening is Chuck Culhane, who is one of the walkers on the Interfaith Prison Pilgrimage. So, Chuck.
Good evening. I did a long stretch in New York's prisons. I did 26 years straight and 3 years on death row. So I have some idea of New York's prison system. I had a friend and a co-defendant who was tried with me for attempted escape and murder, Gary McGibbon. And he died in November, this past November. after being held for a prison violation for possession of a small amount of heroin, two $10 bags. He was held for more than 7 years on a parole violation. In 1985, Governor Cuomo granted him clemency based on the belief that he was innocent of the crime that he was convicted of. And he was innocent. And he took two lie detector tests. And one law enforcement witness who testified against us was asked if he would take a lie detector test, and he wouldn't. So Governor Cuomo's decision was based on pretty good reasons. Gary wrote a poem in 1997, in his third year of the parole violation, and I'd just like to share it with you tonight. It's called Thoughts from Prison. Even tortured days have their end. Exhausted, I cling to the darkness and plunder her for rest. Sleep, savior of the bleary-eyed, embrace me when privacy and order suffer their last violation, when TV cartoons and Latin music cease to clash, when Lady Malapro nods her weary head. But there is no end to the vengeance that drives this engine, only veils that peel away in shifts. I see your naked night sounds punch the clock like hammers on steel. Steam pipes erupt, setting loose souls that race in caged galleries. Dreams die, hitting the wall, splattered into separation without a word of complaint. I sift through the rubble, searching for nourishment. My hands, bloodied by the sharp edge of failure, discover there's nothing to salvage but this great hunger that drives me from the cage into the light, parched and thirsty for civilization. They killed Gary with time, as sure as if they dragged him into the electric chair and through the switch. These are our authorities in government and law, driven by a kind of spirit of what Kropotkin called 150 years ago, a spirit of petty vengeance. And it borders on the criminal. They look at people who are in prison, they look at them as if they're less than human and treat them as such. They put a number on them. When people die in prison, I remember brothers dying of AIDS, they wouldn't even put their names on the crosses when they buried them. They would put their numbers on the crosses. Some of the other issues are restoration of higher education, which is a program that was proven to be effective in stopping people from coming back to prison. It was the one program that you could point to in the prison and say that had an effect on the recidivism rate. All the other stuff, you know, vocational shops and basic education and high school diploma, didn't, you know, it's kind of neutral factors. But higher education, it showed, and one of the studies out of Texas, showed that people with an associate's degree, recidivism dropped 300%, went from 45% to 15%. With a four-year degree, the recidivism rate dropped to 5 or 6%, and with a master's degree, people didn't come back to prison. So the U.S. government, the Senate, and all those Southern Democrats and Republican conservatives in their infinite wisdom did away with the Pell Grants and higher education for people in prison, many of whom didn't have the opportunities to go to good schools to begin with, and was why they ended up in prison initially. Very important. I think that's an issue that something can be done with, because it appeals to the people's common sense. Maybe there's some hardcore racists who don't want to hear anything about anything, but I think a lot of the issues we can put on the table, and even if not from a moral standpoint, always from an economic standpoint, begin to make some inroads. my own feelings on drug policy is that it's supremely arrogant for the leaders in this country and politicians to be punishing people for using drugs. The drugs they use, they can get in the pharmacy, you know, and it's no secret that people can get drugs in, you know, through pharmacies. Alcohol is probably a greater killer in cigarettes than heroin and cocaine and marijuana combined. Drug initiatives to legalize medical marijuana have passed in every state where there's been a ballot initiative, and the federal government turns around and threatens doctors who would write prescriptions for medical marijuana. That's supremely arrogant. But I think that issue is going to, over time, incrementally grow, and more people who say to the government, no, common sense dictates that there's another way rather than going over and souping up armies in Colombia and destroying inner city communities in America. There's a better way to do things in a more humane and more economic and practical way. These are just some of my rambling thoughts that I want to share with you. And the motto for our walk is that we walk with the hope for change. And sometimes we don't see change. A lot of people who are active, like Claire Regan, who is the head of judicial process, she's not with us tonight, but she's been doing stuff and been active in the prison movement since the time of the Attica uprising. And she saw everything, like many activists who have hung in there, and Tom for many years, saw things going backwards in a regressive trend. But I think that the building of the prisons has hit the high water mark and is starting to go back. I think the drug policy, finally people are saying, wait a second, you know, the crime is going down, prison populations are continuing to rise, you know, something's wrong with this picture. And citizens and people in communities like this, when you start to ask questions, when you start to press your leaders and political leaders for real answers and not just knee-jerk bullcrap, that we'll start to get some real responses. We walked the Southport today, and I know public roads, people are supposed to be able to walk on public roads, and they threw up roadblocks and big stop signs. And we got through the first barrier, and then they sent for the state troopers and sheriffs, and they threatened us with arrest. And we weren't ready to be arrested, or we might have been. But these institutions, people are paying for them. Taxes are paying for them. And the money's coming from somewhere. You know, it went from like a $500 million budget with 12,000 people in New York's prisons to whatever it is now, 2 billion plus, with almost 70,000 people in. And that money is coming from somewhere. It's coming from education, which is, you know, which is where it's supposed to be, not in punishing people. You know? Some people need to be confined, but a very small minority. And I mean that in the sense of numbers, not race, like some. I think 75 to 80% of people could be let out of prison tomorrow, and it wouldn't impact negatively on the safety of our communities out here. So I think it's a tragedy what has been going on, but I think it's starting to turn around. And I think the more people raise their voices and start to walk and demand of their government better, I think it can happen. Please join us and thank you.
That was a community forum. New York State Prisons Inside and Out, an invitation to consider needed reforms, that was held on April 12th at Ithaca's Southside Community Center. For more information or to get involved in the prison reform movement locally, contact Edie Regan at area code 607-272-5062. That's 607-272-5062.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. To help these
poor workers, the rich will.